Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead. Look at our schedule. You can listen to past programs. You can sign up for podcasts. All you have to do is go to our website. Take a look at it. In fact, we've just done a redesign in the site and we're really pleased with the way that it looks. So if you haven't been there in a while, well, you might want to check it out. It's will.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything that you need to know about listening to the archives and signing up for the podcast. And as I say, if you're interested in looking at the schedules for Focus 580 and the Afternoon Magazine, get some sort of sense of what we'll be doing here in the next few days, you can do that, and we'd be happy to have you check it out. In this part of the program, we are happy to have back here again on the program Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council that is housed within the School of Architecture here at the University of Illinois. And he's been here on the program before, and we've talked about a lot of different things. We've talked about what architects do. We've talked about the relationship between people who design buildings and those who actually have to build them. We've talked about buildings and why it is that we like some and we don't like others. And we've talked some about preservation issues as well. This morning, we'll be talking about something that I suppose in a way brings all of that together, ties all of those things up, and that is energy efficiency, the way that we use energy in the buildings where we live and work. And this is certainly something that he has been thinking about and working in for a long time now. He's worked as a consultant on some projects that involved big buildings, and some of those indeed were the ones where there were some preservation issues going. We're here to talk a little bit about how we think about what it means to be green and what it is we can do to try to get there, what's involved in reducing energy use or perhaps being more efficient in our energy use. And I think he'd be the first to admit that we have many questions. We don't always have the answers. So we'll talk a little bit about that with Bill. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, give us a call. Join the conversation. Well, thanks for being here once again.
Great to be here.
It's been a while. I'm glad that you could be here. It seems certainly we could say that if you're concerned about things like global warming and how we meet our energy needs in the future and, our energy efficiency. If you're concerned about all those kinds of things, I guess you'd have to say, well, we're making progress, at least in the sense that people are thinking now about this much more than they ever were before.
Right.
And I think many people, in a very sincere way, they want to make their homes energy efficient. They want to cut their energy bills, but they're also starting to think about their carbon footprint. So they're thinking about all those sorts of things. And desperately, I think, needing advice. They're saying, okay, I get it. I get the point. Now what do I do? And it seems that that's actually not always that easy to answer that question, to tell people what it is they can do.
That's right. In our office at the Building Research Council, we run a program called the Smart Energy Design Assistance Program, funding through the state of Illinois, that provides energy assistance to small businesses in Illinois, and now that's been expanded to nonprofits in Illinois. And the other researchers who aren't associated with that program, we all get together and we're all asked, what do I do? What can I do to save energy? What's the best thing to do? And we come up with lists of answers and energy conserving opportunities and ways of prioritizing those. And we're happy to talk about them. But there's another thing we do in our office, and that is we read the news and we look at the data. And we look at the rate at which fossil fuels are being used, the rate at which combustion products are going into the atmosphere, the remaining resources for fuel that are out there. And a real funny thing happens among us researchers. We realize that these two parts of our job, number one, advising people on what's the best thing to do, and number two, looking at the big picture, these twain don't meet very well. There's a big gap between these two approaches to looking at the energy picture on the individual at the individual level and at the global, the planetary level. Where do they meet? What's the midground? How can the one inform the other? That's kind of the question that I've been struggling with for some time. I was out buying flooring materials, and the person who runs the distributorship was showing me his showroom, and he says, you know, people really want to be green. They really want to buy green products, and so we're thinking we're going to carve off a section in our showroom here for green flooring products, because people come in, they're always asking for that. And I say, yeah, okay, that's good. He says, but I got a question. What you mean, green? and he was saying, you know, does it have to do with how it's harvested? Does it have to do with how renewable it is? Does it matter whether it comes from locally or from the Pacific or Africa? You know, how do you judge these things? And I didn't answer that question because I was just buying flooring products, and I didn't have 2 weeks to kind of stand there and puzzle over the same issues, which I would have had to do because I don't have the answers for him. One approach that I have here, I have several approaches, but a couple are sort of fundamental to me. One is you got your consumption and you got your conservation, okay? And if I'm consuming something, I'm not conserving it. And if I'm conserving something, I'm not consuming it. They're opposites in a sense. And much of the sort of retail, wholesale approach that says, how can I make my life greener, comes down to the issue of how can I consume my way to conservation? And that's a tough one to answer. I mean, that's kind of the question that this flooring salesman was struggling with. He was really struggling with, how do you consume your way to conservation? How do we well, that's one way to try to deal with living with a smaller footprint and more modestly in a world of increasingly scarce resources. Another way of approaching this issue would be to just say, I'm going to conserve. And if you do that, you could say, I choose to have my space conditioning utility bill be no greater than $1 per square foot per year. In other words, if I have a 2,400 square foot house, I'm going to keep my gas and electricity down to $200 a month on average, $2,400 a year. Turns out that's not a bad target. It used to be the average, but prices have gone up, so now it's kind of a target value. And if you just say, I'm going to go on a budget, and one way or another, this is all I'm going to spend. And if I budget myself, I'm sure I'm smart enough that I'll come up with ways to save energy. And I applaud that. I like that approach. There's the state of Illinois has mandated the utility companies in Illinois to reduce demand. And the approach that has been taken, and I don't have all the figures in front of me, and if I understand it correctly, is an approach that will reward customers of the utility companies for their investment in energy-saving things, insulation, I suppose, windows. And if you invest in savings, you will have opportunities like this, then you'll have a savings, but it's going to be a projected savings. We don't know how much it's actually going to save. On the other hand, if you budget yourself, you say, here's how much I'm going to spend, I'm not going to spend any more, then we know exactly how much we're not going to spend. These are two different approaches. And incidentally, the utility company has not adopted a program that says we will reward the people who do not use our product. That would have been nice, I think, but it wasn't the approach that they adopted. To characterize these two approaches, one that looks most closely at what the projected savings are. It presumes that people are consumers. They're going to make investment in energy consuming, conserving opportunities, and they're going to reap certain benefits of this. In other words, everything is based on how much projected savings we're going to have. I call that light green. And programs, for example, like the one that the chancellor has recommended for the University of Illinois, saying we're cutting it by 10%. We're talking measured savings. These aren't going to be projected savings. These are going to be actual measured savings, I presume. That's harder. That's tougher. I use the term dark green for energy savings based on measured savings. One question we could have is, how close do we come to measured savings in all of these projected projects? Nobody really has the answer because they come from sort of two different points of view. We have very few buildings that benefit both from activities aimed at finding savings, which are followed up then with measured savings. One is the U.S. Department of Energy weatherization program, very much to their credit. They go back and measure the savings. And what's the discount rate on the projections? I don't know. I've proposed 80%, and everybody goes, no, it's down around 50%. Okay. I don't know, but if we take this past the individual or institutional consumption, consume to conserve approach, and start looking at where we really need to be down the line, it doesn't give you a very buoyant feeling. It's a little depressing. And so where I use the terms light green to express this kind of inspirational, optimistic, I'm going to buy me some new windows and save me some energy, it makes people feel good to make such investments. And in a way, they'd rather do other things than measure the actual results. Mm. The measured results are really what's going to be necessary in order to implement a policy that's going to get us toward some kind of communally decided future that we act upon. And that's tough. It's a little pessimistic. I was just reading some William James, and I was thinking, where can I go to find out how to mediate between these two approaches? And William James has a really nice layout in his first lecture at Harvard on pragmatism, where he says when they were trying to introduce science to the public, a public that really wasn't familiar with science, he said there are tender-minded people and tough-minded people, and the tender-minded people who live by values and principles are often very optimistic, and the people who have to look at the facts tend to be very pessimistic. So I have to go into William James a little bit more to see where he can really help us on this issue, but it's a downer to look at that.
Well, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council that's housed within the Department of Architecture, School of Architecture here at the U of I, and has been with us before to have conversations about design and construction of buildings. And I'm sure we've taken up this particular issue before. And we're coming back here to this issue of energy efficiency in design, construction, maintenance, living in buildings. Questions welcome 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, just for a second to stay with the light green approach, it's something that people we know are thinking about, right, if for no other reason than they're concerned about what they're paying for energy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so and I know the kind of things that we tell people to say, well, here's where we would suggest you start out. First of all, you want to tighten up your house as much as you can, and you want to look at what your insulation looks like. That's not real expensive, depending mm-hmm. on what you already got. Then I suppose we can start thinking about looking at your furnace and your air conditioner. And if you're lucky enough to have an air conditioner, I hope you have a furnace. How old are they? What's their level of efficiency? So you can replace them and have more efficient heating and cooling. Then I suppose if you don't want to go beyond that, I guess you can look at other devices in your home that use energy. How old is your fridge? What kind of energy does it use? And I suppose you can even, those are some of the first things you can go past that. And as I sometimes jokingly tell my wife, well, you got to spend money to save money.
Yeah.
So the idea is up front, this is an investment you're making up front. And if you live in your house long enough, chances are you're going to get that back someday. We can't tell you exactly when. But at today's energy prices, who knows? Yeah. It might be 5-10 years. You would eventually get that back, and so you'll feel good, you'll feel virtuous, and maybe you'll start to see your energy bills will be less. And when you've paid off the cost of your infrastructure improvements, then you'll be doing something. Though I guess that invites the question that, okay, if we get everybody to do this just in their homes. Mm-hmm. In addition to feeling virtuous, would that given how much energy we use in the United States, would we notice?
I'm afraid not. That's what spooks us in the office is that we're not at the point yet of being able to say we have an energy conservation policy, which, if implemented, will point us toward a sustainable future. We don't want to discourage anyone from doing the things that you said, and you laid them out so well, David, so beautifully. You could probably make a pitch for my job.
No.
You did lay them out very, very well, and I hope that you saved me the chore of having to go down exactly that same list. But there are two sides to that question. One is, what can we do after that? Mm-hmm. A second question is, might we go too far in this direction and have other penalties down the line? And then the third question, the important one, is if this doesn't get us where we want to be, what's going to get us where we want to be? So the first question, I had one of the researchers from the Smart Energy Design Assistance Center, and incidentally, everyone should go to, I think it's cedac.org, SEDAC, to take a look at this program. It's very helpful and designed for Illinois citizens with Illinois funding. One of the researchers came to me and said, Bill, I got a problem. I said, what's that? He says, we're looking kind of at a target value of $1 square foot. And I've got a facility that uses $1.16 a square foot. I say, okay, sounds pretty good. He says, it has no insulation. It's a greenhouse, and all it is 10 mil polyethylene stretched on a frame, but it only uses $1.16 a square foot. And I have to advise this guy on how to save money. Well, you don't go adding fiberglass insulation to a greenhouse. And, how can we save money on a building like this? This brings home the notion that it's not our buildings that cost energy. It's our desire for comfort that costs energy. That's what we're really paying for. There's a very interesting statistic from the U.S. Department of Energy, EIS, Energy Information Service, where they looked at the space conditioning energy cost on a square foot basis by age of commercial building. And what we see is a progression upwards over time. If the buildings from before 1919 used the lowest amount of energy, and as we get closer and closer to the present day, on a square foot basis, the space conditioning costs go up, up, up. We might be turning that corner and moving down because there's been a lot of emphasis on energy codes at this point. Why would an old building, and we have buildings from that era here on campus, I'd really love to know the square foot energy costs of old buildings versus new buildings. I think it would be a humbling discovery. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, probably for one thing, you don't have the same expectation of level for comfort. It's harder to find the thermostat and change it around among your office mates. For another, may not have air conditioning in it. For a third, it's going to have smaller windows, less glazing. For a lot of reasons, this might happen. But I just want to emphasize that there's a certain expectation in our way of life that actually keeps seeming to boost our energy use upward. And the next level, and may even deserve to go before the building interventions that you described, is one to say, I think I can live with a wider range of temperature. We just had a discussion about whether you can sweat and do desk work. I don't have the answer to that question. But the second part of the question is, could we go too far? I'm working on the United Nations building, and the project architect in the late 40s, early 50s was Max Abramovitz from Illinois, designed the Assembly Hall and the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. And he designed a heating panel system for the marble walls at the north and south of the Secretariat building. Now there's a lot of money been allocated to upgrade this, and they're saying, oh, we're going to make this a LEED special building. It's going to be a green building. So they said, we're going to add insulation to the building. Okay. But right now they have this heating panel system that keeps the stone warm. They inspected the condition of the stone, and the stone looks as good as the day it was put in 50, 60 years ago. To what extent can that be attributed to the fact that that it's kept warm, it's kept cozy? Warm kind of means dry. Well, to some extent, and I've been asked to study that question, but if we want to keep building materials dry, we kind of have to keep them warm. And there, we might be reaching sort of the trade-off point where we could put so much insulation in a building that we cut back on its drying potential. It's going to be colder, wetter for longer periods of time. And a robust brick building will do fine, but you really insulate a painted wood frame structure with clabbered. The clabbered's going to be wetter, colder for longer, and that paint may not stay on all that well. So it's a little flip from the point of view that I come from to hear people say, let's just insulate, 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 as if this can continue as long as we can afford insulation, and with each additional layer of insulation, there'll be no penalty and only benefits. It doesn't really work that way. We have to be much more specific about our findings.
So just to make sure that I understand and people understand, what you're saying is that you're saying that in fact, maybe a little bit of heat leakage, the fact that the heat that you're putting into the building also helps to warm the skin, might actually be a good thing over the life of the building for the building.
The answer there is yes. That's that is true. Now the question is, there was an article that I wrote that said, should the walls of historic buildings be insulated? I guess maybe you could Google that and find it. Should the walls of historic buildings be insulated? And the paper begins by saying historic buildings, the burden to conserve energy falls on historic buildings exactly as it falls on other buildings. Let's not go making exception for historic buildings. Everyone has to roll up their sleeves and pitch into this chore of getting to the next level. That said, we have to step back and look at the energy-conserving opportunities that there are in historic buildings. And we can change the thermostat, change the attic insulation, add storm windows, close shutters, keep it dark during the summer. There are a lot of opportunities allow the temperature and humidity to float seasonally within a greater range than we have up until now. And if we make a list of what's going to be effective, what's going to have a payback, chances are adding wall insulation falls pretty far down the list. So it's not as though we need to be particularly troubled by this. And I'm not suggesting that anyone should say, maybe I'm not going to save energy because there might be durability consequences. But as a general rule, we will be bumping up against the trade-off point between durability and energy conservation. For most buildings, we're not there yet. So.
Our guest in this hour is Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council that is part of the School of Architecture here at the University of Illinois. He is a licensed architect in the state of Illinois and has been here on the program to talk about a lot of different things about design and construction of buildings, about how we feel about them, why we like some and not others. Certainly, we've talked about this particular issue, energy efficiency. He's one thing he's in his work is very interested in is moisture issues in buildings. We've talked about that. We've talked about a lot of different things. And this morning, we're, again, spending some time talking about the whole energy efficiency issue in design construction of buildings, and also the way that we use them, the way that we live in them. The idea is to talk a little bit more about, you know, what do? We get to this point where we're trying to aim at, where we are getting to a more sustainable way of using energy? Let's talk with a caller. We have a couple here. In fact, we have someone in South Elgin on our toll-free line. Let's call that and talk to them right here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, it just so happens this is right down my alley. I'm also a builder. Mm-hmm. Or /remodeler now because of the building crisis. But I've been looking at this for years, ways to more energize, or should I say try to make more efficient my home. But not only that, my next home I'm trying to design so I don't have to be, independent from most, if not all, utilities. And you can do that, but like you said earlier, the gentleman you have as a guest said it right in a nutshell, and I can't tell people this enough, that if you close your house completely off of anything, your circulation in your house your furnace won't work right because it requires so much energy. Even the new ones that are energy efficient are they need to have a circulation. You close it off, it really won't work as properly as it would be. But the biggest thing I see with people, and this is the most common thing I see, probably 99% of the people I go into when I do maintenance on their houses, they do not turn the thermostats down when it's humid out. And then what happens when that happens, you get the windows sweating and chafing, and then they have problems in bathrooms and ceilings when the paint chips. And plus, they don't change their filters. And that's the biggest common conception people seem to think, that once you buy into a house, your furnace doesn't need any taken care of, or your air conditioning, you know, just the whole house system. And I'm finding this more and more because nobody wants to really pay attention to it. But I'm just wondering, is there a system out there that I know that just totally keeps people from even mess with it, when it will regulate itself? I've never heard of anything. There probably is, but I've never heard of anything. And is that efficient enough for, say, for instance, a regular homeowner who doesn't understand and understand the system? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
I appreciate the question. There were a lot of points you made there, and allow me to focus on the issue of maintenance, and that is that probably the best thing that any homeowner could do to save energy is just pay attention. We've thought about instituting a system called an energy dashboard that would measure temperature and humidity and use electrical and fuel use and everything, and feed it to a receiver that's attached to the computer, that's attached to the website, and you sit there at the dashboard and you can see everything that's happening in the house, and then the website you're attached to is so smart that it can advise you maybe what you might want to try next. There's a lot of opportunity for things like that, maybe to help. For the building that works best on its own with a minimum intervention, I might want to point you toward the Passive House Institute. There are people in Urbana. If you just, I don't know, look up the Passive House movement in Urbana and elsewhere. These are the people trying to come up with designs for buildings that can be heated with a light bulb. Question becomes, what do you do about air tightness? Question becomes, what do we do about air conditioning? They're working with those questions, and they can't promise answers at this point, but these make for really, for houses that answer the question, how low can you go in energy consumption? It's good to take it up with them. But the main point I got from your question was about maintenance. And I think that all of our buildings will continue to require maintenance. And anyone who says, can I have energy conservation and not have to worry about it, I cross them off my list. No, if you want energy conservation, you really got to spend time thinking about it, working on it, and not letting it go as an issue. I passed by, you know, we've got a couple wind farms in Illinois, and I saw the blades turning, except for two, and they weren't turning. And I got to thinking, oh my gosh, are we prepared for the maintenance necessary on wind turbines? I hope so. But wind turbines are just like any other technology that we have. They're going to need maintenance. They're going to need occasional repair. We have to immerse ourselves, I think, more and more in maintenance and repair in order to benefit. We can't move away from it.
All right. Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone in Champaign. They are next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was just, you just happened to me. I was calling about passive solar, and you just made mentioned that. And what I wanted to talk about is I wonder why more large-scale buildings, there are very few of them around, that include passive solar as a part of their design. And it seems to me that that would be a good thing to do. And do you know if there is going to be any greater plans in the future not to ignore the ignore the location of the sun and that sort of thing?
Energy codes are kind of the first key here. I apologize that I don't know where we stand with energy codes in Champaign and Urbana at this point. But if we want to oblige builders to follow certain practices, the only way to do it is through the building code. So someone who knows more on that issue can address it.
Well, what I was kind of thinking about was not about the code so much, because a lot of the things that I'm thinking of, at least, are just simply designing in accordance with the azimuth of the sun.
Oh, yeah.
And positioning windows, locating floors that absorb solar energy.
Overhangs.
Pardon me?
Overhangs on the south side.
Overhangs that go out a certain length that take advantage of that, and then trees that you plant in front of the windows. And it seems that many of the buildings just go up with large-scale glass, south-facing glass, that in the summertime become incredibly difficult to cool, and they're coming up with all of these really complicated glass darkening chemicals and such that it seems as if some simple thought processes would eliminate, and there's very little maintenance that has to go with most solar, passive solar design.
Right.
It seems like it's not included in design. Do you know if that's true or not?
I think it's true.
And why?
Solar principles are discussed at a technical level, but only in a minority rather than a majority of design studio projects are they implemented. But I think there's a growing interest among young architecture students in this area. But there are certain energy-conserving practices that are just very difficult to implement among in standard architect-contractor delivery. For one thing, airtightness in buildings. I think anyone who uses air conditioning in their car on hot, muggy days knows that you really want it to be tight if you're going to air condition effectively. Only that way can you get humidity control as well as temperature control. And if you've ever tried to set a specification for airtightness that's a question of design and construction and can only be tested upon substantial completion of the building, you realize, oh my gosh, our delivery system doesn't allow for certain energy-conserving practices to be implemented. So I sympathize with your regret at driving around and saying, oh my God, this building that promises to be here for 50 years is going to be an energy hog for the next 50 years. I'm greatly saddened by this as well. And if you're familiar with the Passive House Institute, then you're, I'm sure, part of the group that
is
struggling.
No, I'm not familiar with them at all.
Oh, okay.
But I studied with Rodney Wright a number of years ago and read his book and applied it to some classes that I taught.
Great.
And some houses that we've built.
So,
and I just don't understand. It's free.
Yeah,
it doesn't cost anything. It's just a little bit of design.
Yep.
All they have to do is apply the design. Well, thank you for taking my call.
All right,
thanks for the call.
Let's talk again with somebody else here. There's someone in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi. Came up faster than I thought. How much, when you take, in terms of the sun, loss, in terms of, I never realized when I bought this house that how lucky I was that on the east side I don't have any windows at all. And on the south side I was sort of lucky because I was, only had a couple windows, and they're not super large.
Right.
So, is the biggest loss? I mean, in terms of The south side is the one that takes the biggest beating then. Is that correct or not?
Well, no. The south is interesting because the sun that hits the south has a manageable altitude in the sky.
Oh.
It is with overhangs, you can kind of do anything you want with that sun. You can shade it during the summer. You can let it in during the winter. In other words, glazing on the south lends itself to management. East and west glazing see sun blazing in where there's no opportunity for shading devices. And so they can there can be over design or under design there. It's actually not a simple matter at all to design glazing. I think the previous caller was focusing on how important it is, and I agree entirely. But it's also very difficult to do. And I should, in the 1970s, we had the sort of the solar scare that led to a lot of active and passive solar design, and the ideas came out of New Mexico. And as they were needed to be implemented around the country, designers had a great difficulty applying that. And in particular, we never really managed how to air condition a building with the sun.
Yeah.
We're still scratching our heads on that
there,
one.
Yeah.
So it's nice that you live in a house and recognize what potential you can have with glazing as well as what drawbacks it might offer.
Now, what about one of the problems that I had, I did pretty well, except I had three trees very close to each other and on the west side. And one was one of these linden trees that was a real, real problem. Unfortunately, I had it taken out, so I've lost some efficiency there. So I'll have to hurry and get a tree further on the other side. But in terms of we use this, UV or something rather on the inside of the window, does that help to a certain degree, the film or whatever that is?
Well, it's good to have sun come in the wintertime. It's bad to have it come in the summertime. You might think of some kind of shading device like shutters or something like that that would allow you to have some seasonal play. If you put some kind of a tinting film, it's going to prioritize one season over the other.
Now, these are shutters that go on the side that you can actually put over the window. Is that the idea or what?
Yeah, but we know how few homeowners actually want to manage their shutters, but they would be effective.
Mm-hmm. The other one is I read someplace, you know, the biggest problem from my understanding with summer is certainly the humidity. I thought I saw some item or process where you could a dehumidifier that actually exhausts outside. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. A dehumidifier is essentially an air conditioner. They have the same units. You have two halves. One is an evaporator coil that gets cold, and as air passes over it, the air can become cold and humidity can condense and be taken out of the air on that coil. And then there's a condensing coil that exhausts the waste heat, and a dehumidifier has this condensing potential. And it also exhausts the waste heat into the room. I don't want to get into the physics here, but that waste heat helps dry things out. So a dehumidifier that's a standalone kind of dries things out in two ways. But some people in some seasons may not want that waste heat inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are units that that will duct that waste heat to the outside, and these become essentially middle of the room air conditioners, and they're useful and helpful that way.
Well, now if you kept your thermostat at 79 with an air conditioner, you had a Sears not Sears, with the rating.
A SEER rating.
That would be, would that be equivalent to the efficiency of just getting this thing in with the exhaust and taking the humidity out or not?
I'll try to give you a brief answer here. If you want your air conditioner to remove water from the air, do something, anything, to make it run as continuously as possible.
Oh, wow.
Okay. It's short cycling. That is, the unit goes on, and then goes off 10 minutes later. That kind of operation isn't going to be very effective at dehumidification. Long running will, and then that depends on fan size and a bunch of other things.
Mm-hmm. So it's more expensive. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council, which is part of the U of I School of Architecture. We're talking about energy efficiency in buildings, and questions are welcome. We've got one more here at least in Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Does one gain efficiency or freeze up the coils by having the cold water that the condensate that comes off the air cool the incoming liquid from the condenser outdoors?
For the previous caller, I recommended long-term running because the dehumidification, extraction of water out of the air, only begins at some point down the road in the cycle, depending on the system design. And there is a downside to that kind of operation. That is, the coil, if it's starved for air, could get colder and colder and colder and get to below freezing temperatures. And this is we don't want this. Thank you for pointing out kind of the downside that I kind of skipped over. But we don't want to freeze the coil. Anyone who's wondering how can I manipulate my equipment for better sensible cooling temperature reduction or dehumidification, talk to a service personnel or a mechanical engineer. If you're not really familiar with this stuff, you may not want to do it by yourself.
Well, I did increase the efficiency, and they wanted to make all kinds of measurements, and I said, don't do that. I'm happy with what we have. And they said, well, it's 5 tons. I said, 5 tons? Put in 4.
Right.
Well, it turns out the new unit is bigger than the last one, but I figured that at 4 it's going to do what you say is run a long time do mainly dehumidification, which is the most comfortable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also wondering about the waste of the cools going down, pumping into the sewer from the cold water that drips off the evaporator.
Well, good point, but I think you need a pretty sophisticated commercial system to really be able to benefit from condensate water. I haven't seen it done residentially.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go to Charleston here for a caller, line 4. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a comment than a question, but I just really enjoyed the show and agree with the speaker that it's really in this energy revolves around our attitude and our comfort levels. You're hearing a lot of talk now about saving energy and the high cost of gas, and we need to do that. Well, I saw where the Saudi Arabian, at our urging of our government, is going to start increasing oil production, and others may follow suit, and so we'll start seeing a drop again in the cost of gas and et cetera. And then a lot of times, if history is any indication, a lot of the energy to change and to be long-term in dealing with this issue, which we have to do, disappears. So it really, it seems to me, comes back a lot, like your guest said, to our attitude, our comfort level, our willing to make not tough decisions in order to deal with these issues. So Thank you very much, right. And it's been a wonderful program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, so we got maybe about a minute. So if we go back to what we were talking about before, the sort of the standard list of things, when the person says, I want to make my house more energy efficient, what do I do? And there's sort of a standard list of things. And then if you're real adventurous, you know, you can even go further and further. But in addition to that, then, if we said to people, okay, would you be willing to keep your house a little colder in the winter and a little warmer in the summer? Could you cope, you know, in the wintertime, put on a sweater in the summertime, even if you're inside, wear shorts and a T-shirt? You know, could you live with that? Just back off a couple of degrees each way. And if people said, well, yeah, I guess maybe I could, then what would that get us? If we could just get people to keep their house a couple of degrees colder in the winter and a couple of degrees warmer in the summer.
Well, for one thing, you get the best payback because there's zero investment. And I think this is the right approach. I'm familiar with several buildings where the thermostat setting in the summertime may be at like 69 degrees Fahrenheit. And in the wintertime, it's at 74. Well, that's backwards. And what we really need to do is maybe focus on the comfort level and flex in there just to be able to deal with stupidities like that.
Well, we're going to have to stop for this moment. I'm sure on another day we'll talk some more. Bill Rose is research architect with the Building Research Council, part of the School of Architecture here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.